You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, we are covering Dany's 7th POV chapter with medievalist Danielle Alisi. Danielle is in the Department of History and Political Science at Millikan University. Danielle is absolutely the perfect person to help me cover this chapter. Among the classes she teaches at Millikan are A Global History of Slavery and Resistance, Global History of Magic and Witchcraft, and The Medieval World. So you could say that this chapter could be used as content for any one of those three classes. Just a reminder that I am now publishing my show content with comic Steve Osborne in our weekend sessions of Electric Boogaloo. If you can't wait to hear from Steve, check us out over at my other podcast, Cocoons of Horror, where Steve and I laugh a lot about Bram Stoker's Dracula. Okay, without further ado, here is Dr. Danielle Alisi. And can you tell me, is it Alessi or Alisi, or how do I...
It's Alisi. It rhymes with Khaleesi. That...
Perfect.
Yeah, that was something that that people commented on a lot in college when the show was on.
Very good. Very good.
It doesn't help that I also used to go by Danny a lot more often. Yeah.
That one didn't age well, did it?
No, it really didn't. It didn't. Especially, I try to use it on my students. I say, it's Dr. Alisi, it rhymes with Khaleesi, and they don't know what I'm talking about.
Of course not. Of course.
Really sad.
Of course not. They don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. Because they were watching Frozen when Game of Thrones came out.
Exactly. It just goes right over their heads. The other professors get it.
Sure.
Not the kids. But yeah, if people get the reference, then they never forget how to say my name. So that does help me.
That's great. Okay. This is a brutal chapter.
Yeah.
It may be the most brutal chapter. When I was thinking about this, I was thinking, I really need a medievalist on to talk about this with me, because I'm sure that there's a lot of hints and historical, you know, touch points that might help. And I was sort of thinking about it very matter-of-factly. And then when I reread this last night, I was thinking, oh my gosh, this is just a nightmare of a chapter.
Yeah. I definitely, when I was rereading it to get ready, I was thinking, ooh, that it's going to be hard to talk about.
Yeah, really. And if you were going to use this particular chapter in a classroom, you might issue a trigger warning. Would that be safe to say?
Yeah. You know, I usually do a kind of general content warning at the beginning of my classes, like in the beginning of the semester, to say, you know, these are the types of things that are going to come up often because of the nature of the type of history I teach. So we usually have a conversation about that pretty early on. But if something is particularly heavy, yeah, I'll stop again and you know, not spend too much time on it, because that can get that that can be difficult for students in itself and create kind of anxiety going in, but just to acknowledge that, like, hey, this is tough stuff, huh? Like, and then afterwards just say, like, you know, take care of yourselves, and I'm here to talk if you want to, and just kind of just acknowledging that it's not easy to talk about, but that when you do history right, it's going to come up quite often, actually.
Right. Sure. So I should probably just let people know, like, we're going to talk about rape. We're going to have to talk about rape, and we're going to have to talk about human trafficking because it's in this chapter. And that is our warning to listeners. Not that, you know, my guess is that people listening to this know what the Game of Thrones world is like. And so they're not going to be too surprised by it. But I just thought I would mention that this particular chapter is especially brutal.
Right.
I'm going to go ahead and read my synopsis of this chapter, and then we can talk about it.
Okay.
Dany tours the last throes of battle that took place in a Lazarine field. She sees wounded men beheaded and hears screaming horses. But the battle has been won. A rival Khal named Ogo has been raiding a village when Drogo overtook him, wiped out his army, and claimed almost 10,000 slaves. Now the spoils of the so-called sheepmen belong to Dany's husband. But Dany, as much as she tries, cannot abide rape. She ignores the protests of Jorah and almost everyone. She begins to claim women and girls as her own slaves in an effort to protect them. One of these women, it turns out, is a healer. Her name is Miri Mazdur. She claims to have studied healing magic with experts from all over the world. Though she draws suspicion of Hago and Kotho, Drogo seems to trust her to treat his wounds. Miri and company enter her temple, and she mends Drogo's deep cut in his arrow wound. Drogo feels strong enough to ride and commands them to leave the Lazar behind. Danielle, Elise, what do you want to talk about? Should we cover a character, a plot point, a theme, or would you like to just climb the ladder of chaos?
I know there's a lot of different things to talk about here.
A lot of chaos in this chapter.
A lot of chaos, so I feel like that's the move.
Okay, I'll let you go first.
Oh, okay. it's just really choosing which one. Mm-hmm. I think what I want to start with is something that then it comes up so much with Dany's character throughout the series, and I wonder if you would agree that it might be birthed here, which is kind of her white saviorism.
Mm. Right. I think you're right. I think this is the first indication of her trying to... She is trying to play Messiah a little bit, right?
Yeah. And it's interesting because you get it and you sympathize and you see that it's coming from her. In this chapter, it comes from her place of trauma. You know, she's reflecting on, and she says that she knows what it's like to be afraid. And she also, even if she doesn't acknowledge it in the text, we know she knows what it's like to be raped.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's really coming forth, I think, when she has this gut reaction that she's even acknowledging is not in her best interests, right, of her ultimate goals.
Yeah, she really does try to,
you
know, kind of steel her heart against these things, but she can't.
She can't, and so she goes forth, you know, wholeheartedly, and that's Dany's thing, all or nothing, right? Mm-hmm. She's not just going to save one, she's going to save them all and going to create this big, big thing. It's so interesting that that's what she's doing. She's saving the women from rape and not looking at the whole carnage, the whole situation that's happening. She's very specifically, I think, honed in on the issue that touches her most deeply, even if she doesn't vocalize that as much.
Yeah, I kind of feel like, I mean, there's a couple ways to look at this. I think that in the book that I co-wrote, the chapter that we did on this sort of calls that into question. Like, of course, how does she save these women? Well, she enslaves them.
Exactly.
Which is super complicated. But in rereading this chapter, I'm almost thinking, what power does she really have?
Right.
You know what? She's not going to stop them from raiding the village. The village has been raided. She's not going to stop, centuries of Dothraki, warfare ritual. I don't know what else she can do besides hold her tongue to help anything. And I mean, we could certainly a case can be made that she doesn't help anything at all. Right.
Right.
So it's so complex. It's so complex.
It is. It's so interesting and it's so difficult because it's complex, because you can't really come down on either side definitively. Everything has a but she saves them, but she enslaves them. But what other choice did she had? Do nothing. And she's kind of operating within her own context of being a woman and a foreigner in this culture, has a little bit of privilege as the Khaleesi and having the kind of the love and the devotion of the cow, but she's operating within the space that she has. But I think it's really interesting to see what the results of that are and how then she starts to mimic these patterns on really large scales from book to book.
Yes. Right. No, I like that you're noticing here that we're seeing some seeds planted for sure, because this will be her move again and again, right? She'll walk into a culture that's not her own, notice an injustice, and try to solve it, right? So,
yeah.
And I think that that's part of why we love Dany. at least we love her in the early parts of her story, right?
Yeah.
But the way that she ends up doing it is almost always fraught with complication.
Yeah, and I even wonder too, is it not what she does? I mean, because like we said, what choice does she realistically have? Do nothing? I mean, do we agree with that? I don't think so. But is it more that how she feels she should be treated because of it? Because there's this line that I wrote down towards the end where it says, Dany felt she could trust this old plain-faced woman with her flat nose. She had saved her from the hard hands of her rapers after all.
Right.
And that's going to come back, later when in more discussions between Dany and Miri Mazdur about, I saved you. Well, save me from what? Right.
Mm-hmm.
That, and I wonder if really that's the thing to highlight here is not so much what she does, though it has its complications. As you said, it's she's saving them through enslavement, and that needs to be interrogated. But that she thinks that she should be, that's an alliance, that she's owed something.
Right. I think this comes back to the old ethical question, is it really altruistic to help someone if you're doing it because it makes you feel good, right?
Mm.
I think it does make Dany feel good. It makes her feel powerful. It makes her feel like she's, making this horrible scene just a little bit better by saving these women from being raped. And honestly, I think in the moment, she's a teenager. How can I really fault her for using whatever power that she has in her hands right then? Wise or not, how can I fault her for trying to bring a little bit more humanity to this horrible situation? She doesn't know what's going to happen next. All she knows is that she might be able to save a few of these women from being raped, right? And I think that that's what she's trying to do.
Yeah.
So you're right. Early stages of Dany's silver savior complex, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and it is inherently complicated, right? We like Dany. We like what she's doing. We don't want these women to be assaulted in this way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a she's kind of operating. She is both assimilating to this culture and also outside of it in some really interesting, complicated ways. But yeah, I mean, we can't also just look away from that. This is a white woman commenting on the brown people she's saving, and that's something that needs to be acknowledged too.
That's right. And I think that another way to look at this is to say, because we're kind of tricked into rooting for Danny, right? I think every indication in this book so far is that we are supposed to be on Danny's side. We want good things to happen to Danny, right? And yet, because of that, we're almost rooting for Danny and Khal Drogo to continue their love affair. I think it's pretty clear that Khal Drogo is a monster. I mean, not through Danny's eyes, but that's part of the trick here, is that we're rooting for Danny, and so sort of by proxy, we're rooting for Khal Drogo. And yet he's sitting there cross-legged with a pile of heads taller than he is next to him. I mean, it's pretty grotesque. This guy he's a warlord in every sense of that term, for sure. And a human trafficker, and who knows how many women that Drogo's raped this day. We don't know that. But you kind of get the sense that this is how the Dothraki function. This is what they do after they take a village. They enslave people, they sell their slaves, they rape women, they kill young boys, they sell children into into sex trade. This is all very gross, gross, gross stuff. And I think as a reader, I'm supposed to be thinking, maybe I have misjudged, maybe my feelings have been misplaced about Drogo.
They're definitely, they're that's a love story, and we are, as you say, tricked into rooting for them, especially in the show. That's definitely there. But if you're looking at it from a medievalist perspective, there's a real East versus West Orientalist conversation happening here, that these are,
Interesting.
they've been compared to the Mongols, or there's kind of these nondescript Eastern tribe in the text, right? Like it's not always clear, but it's there's a strong Mongol comparison, I think, to be made, in the conquest and the pillaging and the rape after the conquests. And then the even just the rampant slavery in the East in the book compares so much to the way the West, the medieval West, viewed the East, as harems and sex slavery, and it's exotic. It is it's rampant with slavery, and so the texts that come out of that, the stories that come out of that, do have this negative, but also sometimes sexualizing element to it. Like there's fantasy in there, right? An erotic fantasy to that. And I almost wonder if that's somewhat playing out in this story, that it's like she has this Stockholm syndrome experience, right? But is it in another way of looking at it, like going, the quote unquote going native, right? She starts to assimilate into these people that she's been, and in the beginning, forced into, right? She's married off. It just tracks distressingly well into some of these old medievalist and early modern stories of people being sold into Ottoman harems and things like that.
Tell me, as a medievalist, tell me if you would agree with this statement. So the Dothraki are not so much based on the actual Mongols, but based on the Western mythology of the Mongols.
Yes, yeah, I agree with that. So
Right?
there's almost no real comparison to be made, other than perhaps the affinity for, I mean, just being pastoralist and having a closeness to the horses. But yeah, it is definitely a bastardized version of that.
Right. I think it's an important distinction because I think that some folks might be tempted to say, well, this is what happened in history. Martin is just mirroring with how brutal the world was back then. And I think it's important to say that, well, yes, the West did view the East as, you know, sort of a land of savages, right?
Right.
That is through Western eyes. And, of course, it works for the story because we're being introduced to the East through Danny's eyes, and she represents the West, I suppose. But it's an important distinction to make to think, okay, no, Drogo is not based on Genghis Khan. Drogo is based on the rumors and the sort of the slander and the worst fears about Genghis Khan.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's worth noting too that it's created in this dichotomy as if the West isn't perpetuating the same war crimes in their conflicts.
Sure. Yeah.
Right. Like that's Dany's point of view for sure. Right. That because she doesn't know Westeros, she doesn't know that, you know, burning down villages and raping people occurs in conflicts there too.
Isn't that always the case when we want to create a monster out of another culture? We imagine our worst selves in them, right?
Yeah, it's.
So we know what war is like, right? The Western folks know what, you know, what war is like and what happens in our wars. And then, of course, if we want to create monsters out of other folk, we just imagine that they're like us, but even worse. And I think that that's probably the root of what's going on in this chapter.
Yeah, and by far, Mongol enslavement and even like post-conquest enslavement, it definitely did not function the way it's being played out in Game of Thrones. Typically, it'd be conscription into the Mongol army.
Interesting. Okay.
And yeah, I think the one of the most important distinctions to be made is it was certainly not so much more practiced in the East than the West, right? Mm. That this is kind of something that it was existing throughout the world in different forms at all times. And that there was really no place that could be fully absolved of it.
Right. No. And that point is well taken. So thank you for that for sure. And I think it's helpful to remember that in Martin's words, what he'll do is he'll take a historical detail like this and he'll like paint it in like neon and he'll turn it up to 11. So he's always using sort of these exaggerations to tell his story.
I mean, it's a fantasy, right? Right. This is right. No one's asking for, I think, historical accuracy here. What is so interesting about it is that it has these threads that we could follow and say, what does this tell us about the way we have viewed history?
Yeah, right.
Or even in contemporary times, right? What is this story and its complexities and our kind of messy, unsure feelings tell us about how we view white saviorism, colonialism. Mm-hmm. That I think is the real power of what he's doing here, because like you said, by painting it in neon, it makes us look at it. We have to look at it. We can't look away. It's right there on the page. Mm-hmm.
Right. The other thing, and this maybe relates to this conversation, but I noted it. It's an interesting word that Hago uses for Miri Mazdur. He calls her a Magi. Mm. And so in my work on the ancient Middle East, it's interesting that this is actually a word that has an analog in Greek, which goes back to Persian. And it's basically the idea of magic. It's a person who is... It's never sort of this term magos or from the word goes. This is a term that's almost exclusively used in a derogatory way. So like modern times we have the idea of like a magician, which it doesn't necessarily, it's not like an insult or whatever.
Right.
But in the ancient world, the only people that you would accuse of being a magician or a practitioner of magic is usually a foreigner with an exotic or a religion to be feared or a system of worship to be feared or rituals to be feared. So there's sort of an implicit xenophobia that's baked into that idea.
Yeah.
And so we kind of see that mentality on the lips of Hago here. She, you know, Miri Mazdur says that she's a god's wife. Mm-hmm. You know, she heals in this temple. Those are her terms. Now, from the Dothraki perspective, she's a witch.
Right.
Right? And so that clearly the word Magi is basically a derogatory term that says, you know, this is a boogie person. This is someone to be feared. This person is a person who consorts with demons, and you know, you can sort of work at all of the usual tropes in that
the blood magic.
Yeah, the blood magic, all of that business. So I thought that was an interesting detail because I think a lot of Dothraki is just gibberish, which, you know, David Peterson has had to create a system of linguistics around, you know, but this was back before there was any sort of linguistic paradigm to Dothraki. This is just Martin inventing words. But in this case, he absolutely does borrow this term.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely clear. And I'm so glad you brought it up because it was one of the things I did want to get to, which is the magic and witchcraft element. Mm-hmm. That is so interesting to me. I think that the term is doing exactly what you're speaking about here. It is not just indicating magic, right? They don't call her a witch. It's very specifically indicating magic that is foreign,
yeah.
Magic that is other.
Yeah, demon magic.
And the fact that it is related to the religion, I think speaks so true to what we just see happening time and time again historically throughout the world, throughout the history of witchcraft. I teach a witchcraft class here at the university, and last semester we you know, as a class kind of kept finding this theme, and the students were realizing, and it was so interesting to see them come up with this idea that, oh, actually magic is just religion that other people have not recognized as religion, right?
Exactly. It's xenophobic. It's a xenophobic view of someone else's ritual, right?
Yeah, so that was really interesting.
Or it's just totally built on, you know, myth, right? It's totally built on, you know, some kind of cautionary tale that someone's invented.
Yeah, but we certainly see with this character, she is, you know, God's wife, priestess of some form, but also a healer, and how those two things are put together, that's really true, you know, historically. Mm-hmm. The way she's described as being older, not getting the same physical attractive features ascribed to other characters. Mm-hmm. That's so textbook witch character, right? And in the agency that she exerts, she speaks out. She's the only one to speak out. She knows all these languages. I mean, there's just something in the way that her character is presented that is just signaling to all of us, you know, mentally, witch, right?
Yeah.
And there's a foreboding in that, I think, because of what's to come. But because it's played against this Orientalist perspective, right, othering experience, we also, there's some sympathy there too, especially in her speech, like we feel weird about it,
yeah.
Right? Her position, and I wanted to ask you on this because I'm thinking about this role, this witch character, right? Do we see in the series, and of course, is like where every element of the series has complications to it, but do we feel like we see in the series a lot of instances where the female characters doing magic are coded negatively? Versus
that's a good question.
I mean,
that's
the
a
witch
really good question.
Figure is definitely not our most celebrated figure in this text. There's something really kind of dark and complicated about them, the Melisandre and the other witches.
Okay, you know what? I think I have a few ideas about this. Let me, before I go that direction, let me read this one passage, because I think it kind of illustrates what you were talking about here. Where did you learn your magic? You know, where did you learn your healing, Miri Mazdur? This is Dany speaking. She says, "My mother was a god's wife before me and taught me all of the songs and spells most pleasing to the great shepherd, and how to make the sacred smokes and the ointments from leaf and root and berry. When I was younger and more fair," interesting that she adds that note, "I went in caravan to Ashai by the shadow to learn from their mages. Ships from many lands come to Ashai. I lingered so long to study the healing ways of distant people. A moon singer from Yogos Nai gifted me with birthing songs. A woman of your own writing people taught me the magics of grass and corn and horse. And a maester from the Sunset Lands opened a body for me and showed me all the secrets that hide beneath the skin." And Jorah Mormont spoke up. "A maester? Morrowind, he named himself," the woman replied, "in the common tongue. From the sea, beyond the sea, the seven lands," he said, "the Sunset Lands, where men are iron and dragons rule. He taught me this speech." Okay, so interesting here, a couple things here. You're probably right that there are some parallels in how foreign women are depicted in this show, or in the books in the show. The only other time that the term Sunset Lands is used is, as far as I can tell, is on the lips of Melisandre. Right? So we have a parallel here. These are two women who practice some kind of, you know, perceived magic. They're foreigners, but they have nothing else in common. They don't come from the same place. They don't practice the same stuff. But they're both using this terminology of Westeros. So it's almost like sort of garden variety witch language. Mm-hmm. And yet, let me spin this around a little bit. It could be that when she's working how she normally works, she's just a healer. But in order to do dirty to Drogo, is it possible that she's actually using Westerosi knowledge? Because she's basically, you know, who is Marwyn that we can tell? He's a maester that's sort of been ousted by the Citadel. He's from Westeros, although he's kind of traveling all over the place. And she learns how to, like, make someone a walking dead man from Marwyn. I mean, that would be one way to read this. So the witchcraft is actually coming from Westeros, if I'm reading this correctly.
Yeah, it's super interesting, right? Because it turns everything back on its head. Because for me, what I notice in that passage is that she receives her legitimacy in especially Jorah's eyes,
yeah, right.
by being trained by a maester,
right.
So a man from his religious experience.
Yeah, she actually has a worthy degree, right? So
yeah.
Of an institution that we recognize. And yeah, that gives her credibility in, I think, Jorah's eyes and Dany's eyes, right? They no longer view her as sort of a foreigner who just practices, you know, witchcraft. She's actually studied. We can trust that she's studied
and
Western medicine.
Arguably, as you're saying, it's the maester who's doing the dark magic, but because he's the man in the institution, that, you know, then it's not magic anymore. It's science.
That's right. That's right.
And I think that is just, that's so fascinating. And
it's fascinating
science
for sure.
She turns on them. Yeah.
Right. It's fascinating for sure. And I think that in general, what you're saying about how this is gender coded is probably true. But I think that we're going to hear more about Marwyn. Mm. And we've absolutely seen Qyburn do crazy stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is not in the books, but in the show, Varys claims that the man who cut him is like this sorcerer from, you know, from another land.
Right.
And he ends up like capturing the sorcerer and having him in a box or whatever. That's not in the books. So I think we might be looking at more of an Orientalist sin here rather than necessarily a gendered sin. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that definitely makes sense. Like I said, I was just kind of wondering as we're rereading through, it's something I want to pay more attention to, but I do think, I mean, yes, maybe he's called a sorcerer, but you know, this term witch in the way that it's used against the women, and we don't really see the women's magic ever being viewed as science.
That's true. That's totally true. And the women,
I think that both things are happening. I think there's something to look for there.
I think you're probably right. Yeah, the way that the Amege is described, from Danny's point of view, is it's a woman who sort of consorts with demons, and then this woman will come and suck the life force out of a man.
Yeah, I mean, that's
you're right. So that absolutely is gendered for sure. But it's interesting to me that and the text doesn't necessarily say this. Maybe I'm blaming Marwyn when I shouldn't be, but I do wonder if what Marwyn does to Drogo is analogous to some of the stuff we see Qyburn doing.
I think that'd be so cool. I've never thought of that before, and I definitely now I'm going to be looking for that. Uh-huh. And it brings me, so one of the questions I wanted to know, and I think about this, I've always thought about this from the very beginning. Do we think that Mir Muzder harmed or started the process of harming Drogo in that moment with the first healing? Did she try to heal him in that moment and then seize her opportunity later? I think that that's such a ambiguous moment.
Yeah. It's interesting. The way that I have read her, and I'd be willing to be pushed on this, but the way that I've read her is that she knows what she's doing. It seems like she's got a plan from the start. She speaks up, right? She says, look, I can help you, Silver Lady. And so from my perspective, it's always been like she knows her end game from this starting point. Mm. Now, why do I think that? I don't know if I have good evidence for that. I just feel like she's such a powerful character who seems to have it all together. She's probably, under the surface, she's probably the person that looking back, knowing what I know about the series, she's probably the person I ought to be rooting for in this chapter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Even though it feels weird because Danny's a teenager and I want, you know, I want good things to happen to Danny and all that stuff. What she ends up doing, she's basically defending her people. I don't know how much she knows about the stallion who mounts the world, but it can't sound good to her ears.
Right.
And if she can avert a future conquest, then maybe she's justified in what she does.
You know, when you think about the language being used there, and especially with the nature of what this chapter is about, what do those words also mean? Conquest, mounting, mounts the world.
Yeah.
I mean, rapes the world. That's what she's I think hearing in this,
right?
I think in quite literally and also metaphorically what these aggressors, these conquerors mean to her. And I agree. I think that this is her chapter. And if we were to read it from her point of view and she was our main character, that is absolutely what we're reading. This is resistance.
I think there's lots of ways we could fault Martin, but I think that in this way, I think he deserves some credit here. I think when I think Joko says, let me make sure I have this right. I think when Quotho says, he's not, what are you talking about? He's honoring her. We know that the lamb people lay with sheep. And so he's like, he's doing her an honor. I think that we are supposed to read this text from a feminist perspective. we're supposed to see how monstrous a statement like that actually is.
Yeah.
From Danny's point of view, that absolutely can't be true. And so there's the only right way to read this is from a feminist perspective as this chapter is constructed. That absolutely is inviting me, through Danny's eyes, to see rape for what it is. And so sort of expanding that to the wider world of conquest. You know, Stallion Who Mounts the World, now that's not how the Dothraki would see it. They wouldn't think of it as rapes the world. But that concept of rape is totally encoded.
Yeah.
In the title of Danny's unborn child, right?
I think so. I think I agree. I think the text is doing that. I think Martin is doing that. He's created this situation in which we do root for Danny and Drogo and all, and we, you know, we like the Dothraki on some level, but we can't read this chapter and not see it for what it is and not read it in that way. And what stands out for me, you know, the most is in that quote that I read earlier when she says she saves her from the hard hands of her rapers, when she says, after all. I mean, it's just in that one additional line, after all, it hints to us that he's writing that in to hint to us that she's wrong to say that, right? This is not going to bode well. After all, it does something than just matter of factly saying she saved her so she can trust her. Like, after all adds this kind of ignorant naivete
right
to it.
I think you're totally right. I missed that, but you're right that the way that that's phrased immediately makes you question the validity of the statement.
Absolutely. I mean, it is Chekhov's gun, right? As soon as she says she can trust her, we know she cannot trust her, right?
Yes, absolutely. Oh my gosh, that's a great point. I hadn't seen that.
Yeah. And you know, I think that it's this is also reading it again, knowing where Danny's going to go as a character. What Martin does so expertly is make us root for the villains. And in this case, you know, Danny's not the villain yet. And she's a product of many things that's happened to her. But I do think we're seeing her on the way to something, and how she turns, you know, and punishes Miri Mazdur at the end. You know, this is a character who was assaulted, who had her whole community destroyed, was treated cruelly the entire time, and who was resisting her oppressors, and then she's killed for it, right? To Miri Mazdur's point, how many women did she save from Khal Drogo and from the sun? I think that is, you know, as difficult as it is to see through the lens of the characters we root for, that's what we're talking about here.
Right. I think that what I had forgotten about this chapter was that the Dothraki came upon this village as it was already being raided, right? So Khal Ogo was sort of treated like a brother in a previous chapter because you don't do violence under the Mother of the Mountain. Is now out in the open field, and his people are pillaging this village. You can just imagine that, you know, all of these, the Lazarene folk have already undergone this horrible treatment once already. And then when Drogo comes along, he doesn't just start raiding the village. He has to conquer the previous Khal first.
Yeah.
He doesn't just kill him. He kills his son and he brags about it, right?
Also, so what's interesting about this chapter too, and really holistically Danny and Jorah's experience with the Dothraki, is that we are looking at, you know, Western people living with an Eastern pastoralist society, and they're the others. And that comes out a lot.
Yeah.
And so the comments about Jorah's armor, right, and how that played out, and the jokes about their skin or their hair or their eyes, or their customs, it stands out to me because there was Western European contact with the Mongols at a couple of different points. And in those accounts, the Mongols typically did laugh at the Western Europeans and their customs and make fun of them. And that did stand out to me because I was recently reading about that teaching about that. And it's just that there is, we can flip the othering on its head too. And it's an interesting perspective to see that these are societies that have their own customs and they're not always being viewed through a Western lens, but that Western people are being viewed through their lens.
Interesting.
Too. And that plays out here.
Yeah. I was looking at a travel narrative maybe a year or so ago, so I might not remember this perfectly, but it was like a traveling priest who spent a couple years with the Mongols.
Yeah.
And you know, with the hope that eventually he might convert, but you know, he wrote a lot about the Mongols' perspective of the West.
Right.
And one of the things he writes is that of course the West is specifically with respect to Christianity is somewhat hypocritical because, you know, the Mongols know the West mostly on the battlefield,
right,
and through business dealings and whatnot. Of course, that looks very, very different than the West from a sort of a religious perspective. And so this traveling priest was noting the inconsistencies from a Mongol perspective on the West. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let me just note a couple differences here that I thought were interesting here. So when Danny says, hey, stop raping her, and I'm going to take her as my slave, and I'm going to take all these women as my slaves, I noted that Jorah says, "You're so much like your brother." Mm-hmm. And that's not in the show. And she says, "Viserys? Like, oh no, are you insulting me?" And he says, "No, Rhaegar." And I thought, oh, okay. Knowing what we know about the Rhaegar narrative in retrospect, it's interesting because we could take this in a couple ways. You know, is she like Rhaegar because she's overly compassionate, right? Because the rumor is that Rhaegar raped Lyanna. And so does that fit with the rumors we've heard of Rhaegar? Or is she more like Rhaegar because, you know, she's got this fiery dragon sense of self because, you know, she kind of steals herself and she, you know, she says, I'm the blood of the dragon. So it's a little bit ambiguous there why Jorah notes that she's like her brother. And I think that we're meant to question, well, in what way is she like Rhaegar?
And I think that there's another way, a subtextual way to read that, especially with the hindsight of more of the series, is she like Rhaegar in that her decision-making, her passion decision-making will veer her off course from ultimate victory.
It's ultimately unwise. She's acting out of what she thinks is compassion, but ultimately she's doing something that's very unwise politically.
Yeah, that will harm her in the end.
Yeah.
Sure. And it's just interesting to read that. But I think we start to see in the book, especially in the show, they can't really do it because it would seem so, the payoff is so far away that it would seem largely out of place, I think.
Uh-huh.
But to drop these seeds that the story about Rhaegar is not what we think.
Interesting. Yeah. No, I think you're right. And I think that there's no way to know that on first read, right? I think it's just,
right.
It's something that's it's a little Easter egg that rewards on reread for sure.
Yeah. And I do think that it starts to ramp up. You know, you get this perspective from Dany's side about Rhaegar and her family and what that was like, and it shows that, you know, people who are on different sides of the war are going to have different opinions on the people they fought for. And then when we ultimately learn the truth, it has just so much more power to it that she's like Rhaegar, and that's a good thing. He was a good guy.
Yeah, right. The other thing I noted, I just rewatched the scene in the show, and Dany plays very differently in the show, especially when she interacts with Drogo. In the book, she kind of snaps. She kind of says, You know, I think one of Drogo's blood riders says something like, what are you talking about? Take them for wives. You know, horses don't meet with, you don't make a home with the sheep or something like that.
Yeah.
She snaps and she says, well, the dragons eat both horses and sheep alike.
Yeah.
And Drogo kind of admires this. He's like, yeah, see? Yeah, that's my son giving her fire, you know. In the show, she really gets diminutive. She gets on her hands and knees and she says, oh, no, please, please help. You know, let this woman heal you. There's none of that fiery stuff in that particular scene. And it's really important because who is to blame for Miri Mazdoor killing Drogo in the show? Well, it's Dany, because Dany begs. She's on her hands and knees. She's begging, please let this woman heal you. In the book, none of that's there. In the book, what happens is she says, why would you want to heal my Khal? And then she goes on this thing, you know, theologically, you know, we worship the great shepherd and we're all sheep. And so, of course, I would want to heal a fellow sheep. And Drogo just says, do it. So
yeah.
Dany never begs for it. Dany doesn't tell Miri to do it. It's Drogo. Drogo, it's almost like he's like, look, enough talk. Let's just do this. And so Drogo is responsible for his own fate in that way.
And it's interesting, too, when you look at the book version that way, because later Drogo says, you know, you don't ask a slave, you command them.
Yeah.
It's almost like he's not viewing, he doesn't see that there could be agency. Yeah, on this person, that she would have an
clearly,
agenda.
Yes, clearly he underestimates her, right?
But Dany immediately does. Why would you want to heal him, she asks. She even subconsciously realizes, like, huh, and she has to convince herself mentally, I can trust her because I saved her, right? Her instinct isn't that this is automatically going to work out for her. So it is kind of interesting how it plays out differently in the book. In both scenarios, you know, she plays, as you said, she plays so different. She's fierce and she's a little bit smarter and more suspicious in the book than she is in the show. In both cases, you know, we could read her relationship with Drogo as genuine love. I think they grow to love each other, but also some Stockholm syndrome. What choice does she have? And her life is miserable before they have a companionship.
Right.
And when they have this love together, when she earns his respect as a partner, she is more inherently powerful. Right? She's empowered by that. And so her power at this point is really dependent on him. And in either case, I think you see that playing out, that especially in the show where she's begging him to be saved. Okay, sure, because she loves him, but she needs him too. She needs him for, otherwise she's nothing. So it's just kind of interesting to note that there's more going on, I think, under the surface than her just having fallen in love with her oppressor, but that's a position for many pre-modern queens, that through that intimacy, however it's gained and obtained, is where a lot of that internal power lies.
Yeah, and even so, even with Drogo, he admires her fire, and I think he does actually genuinely admire it, because I think he's fallen in love with her.
Yeah.
But what does he say to his blood risers? He says, listen to her. That's my son talking. You're right.
Yeah.
So that gives her her power is through her husband, but her husband is able to justify that because she's carrying his son.
Yeah, that's what makes her strong and fierce. And we know that's not it. And yeah, I absolutely think that's so just such an interesting moment that's said and that's enforced, that for pre-modern queen woman, she's getting her power not through her relationship with her husband, but she's carrying his child. And at that point, she's never had more power and she'll never have more power, though we know it's going to change because of what does happen, right? We're in a fantasy book, but that's her, that very metaphorically is where a lot of her power is coming. And he makes it very literal. Like that's, you know, the fire coming out of her is literally the sun inside of her. And I think that's an interesting touch.
Notable introductions in this chapter. We hear the name Marwyn for the first time. I think he's going to be important in future stories. We meet the Lazarene for the very first time. Of course, we meet Miri Mazdur, who's described as heavy and flat-nosed. She calls herself a god's wife. We meet the word Jaka for the first time. In Dothraki, Jaka is executioner. Although Dany describes them as mercy men. You know, these are men who've been wounded on the battlefield. And so these executioners just come take their heads and end their misery. So from one perspective, they're mercy men. And from another perspective, they're executioners. Notable departures, although we don't see it happen on screen, Ogo and his son Fogo depart the narrative, as short-lived as it was. I also wanted to point out one more show difference. In the show, they actually have Drogo, like, fight one of his blood riders, and that's how he gets wounded, right?
Yeah.
They get into a little argument, and Drogo, you know, kills him, but then Drogo takes a little wound, and that's when Miri Mazdur steps in. In the book, that doesn't happen. And it's basically, look, I killed this Cal, but he, you know, he cut me before he died. And so he's already wounded when Dany comes upon him.
And so to your point, in the show, it becomes even more Dany's fault because the fight is over her, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, she's the problem. It's so interesting that the particular choices that they make.
Yeah. Frustrating.
Sometimes. I think it's a little bit. Yeah, I do think that they dulled down what we actually see of the battle in the show. I think that this book is more brutal as the executioning and the young boy who tries to run away and gets shot in the back, tortured and then shot in the back, and then the depictions of rape. That is absolutely toned down in the show. So I think it kind of cuts both ways. I think there are absolutely instances where the showrunners insert a rape where there was no rape before, right?
Right.
And of course, they definitely deserve to be interrogated for that, right?
Yeah.
In this case, they seem to have dulled the grotesque realities of war, I guess, for whatever reason.
Right. Yeah. And not to say that that's the wrong choice. That's not what I'm saying. But when you read it in the text and there's all of these things ramping up around her that she's watching, and it's not just the rape, but it's just the overall cruelty, the torture, you can kind of see why she snaps in the way she does.
Yeah, sure.
And makes this decision that is going to kind of start the ripple effects from there on. It is less out of it's the dread is building in a different way in the text.
Right. I think you're right. Absolutely. Okay. Well, right. Danielle, I thank you so much. Such a complex and interesting chapter. I really appreciate your insights.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans.
That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I'd like to revisit a somewhat controversial topic, and that is the casting of Targaryens of color in the new HBO adaptation, House of the Dragon. I was reading through Dany's ninth POV chapter, and I encountered an interesting image. Dany is imagining, in her dream, what her grown son might look like. So this is the son that she might have had with Drogo, and this is what it says. She could feel the heat inside her, a terrible burning in her womb. Her son was tall and proud, with Drogo's copper skin and her own silver gold hair, violet eyes shaped like almonds. Now, of course, this is a what might have been in Dany's dream. And of course, we see Martin's Orientalism come in. This Mongol-like people look like they have copper skin and almond eyes. This is a very Western perspective on this nomadic people. And again, this is in a dream. I want to call that out. But I also want to call out that it is absolutely within the realm of Martin's imagination that a character with dark skin, wed to a Targaryen, might sire a child with that typically silver Targaryen hair. As Martin puts it here in book one, Drogo's copper skin and her own silver gold hair. I would argue that it absolutely does no damage to the world-building efforts of this first book to cast someone with dark skin as a Targaryen in this upcoming series. Book at baldmove.com if you have any thoughts along these lines. And that is all for this week.